Hey, what's up? This is episode 002 of Champagne Sharks. I'm your host, T, and with no further ado, let's get to it. So let's get down to business. I opened up Curious Cat. For those who don't know, that's the website where people ask you questions and you can answer them. And I told people I will answer some questions on the podcast. The ones that are minor or not too interesting, I'll just answer on the website, Curious Cat. But the ones I thought were kind of interesting, I'll save for the podcast. So that's what today's episode is. Before we get to that, I just wanted to go over some stuff that happened during the week. Miley Cyrus had come out and said that she is no longer down with the rap music. She's not with the hip hop. That's it. It's dead. She's a white girl again. You know, it happens. And it's one of the things I said was going to happen. I like that it did, because it confirms a lot of things I was saying. And in the last podcast, I was saying how a lot of times white people kind of put their dark side or their ratchet side or whatever you want to call it, they like to displace it into black people and have it there to access when they want to reclaim, you know, a certain type of rebellious or dark side or wild child image. But they also put a lot of the bad demonic stuff there too. So it's a balancing act. They want to access it from black people when it's convenient, but they also realize that they risk accessing what's viewed as the bad side of human nature, which they also project into black people. So Miley was a corporate Disney machine. She was viewed as something soulless, as a clinical, calculated product. She had to break out of that. She had to do the same thing that Justin Timberlake did. You know, he's a Mickey Mouse Club alum. He's a part of a manufactured boy band. He gets a black person to help him. He gets Timberland, and he gets you know, that production, that black cosign, and you know, he gets a certain amount of soul. I mean, it backfired to a degree because he was trying to do that with Janet Jackson. And he ended up accidentally getting a lot of the bad part of being associated with a black person. So he distanced himself quick. He was like, hey, yo. Hold on, I'm not that black yet. I'm slowing my own roll. Laid low for a little bit. Then he came back with Timbaland. And he was able to access that blackness a little At a better pace, a pace he was comfortable with. You know, he, when Janet Jackson was getting that backlash, and a lot of it was extra because she's a black woman and she carries all that Jezebel cultural baggage that comes with being a black woman, Timberlake felt kind of foul of that balancing act I was discussing in the last episode. But back to Miley. She came out and she's like, look at me, I'm ratchet now, I'm Miley, you know, I'm not this corporate thing anymore. A lot of black people kind of co-signed and welcomed her. She put a bunch of black people on stage at the awards like a prop. A lot of people laughed at her, but it worked. I mean, look at her now. She's kind of respectable in her own way. I mean, not when I say respectable, I mean respectable as far as having a sense of authenticity. She's not as corny to listen to or look at or take seriously. Now, okay, so she uses black people to get this authenticity, this emotional depth, this dark side, and then the job is done. She can now be white again, but she has to kind of purge a little bit of that negative baggage that came along with that. Because like I said before, there's like a bad side to everything. So she comes out this week and she starts bad-mouthing hip-hop and the misogyny in it and all those things that she kind of has to do to, you know, get back in with the white people. She's kind of doing the white feminist card now. And a big thing with white feminists lately has been kind of to throw black men under the bus. And you can do it because a lot of the black feminists will co-sign you on it. They're the safest people to kind of throw under the bus. So it's similar to like how that whole street harassment thing happened a couple of years back in the UOKSIS hashtag. And the big thing they did was make the black men the face of that. And it was okay. A lot of it kind of was uncommented on. A lot of people didn't call them on their racism in doing that. So I predict she's kind of probably going to do an Emma Watson route from now on and just try to get on that white feminist card. And, you know, more power to her. A lot of people predicted it. And black people are going to keep falling for it. So fool me once, you know, shame on you, and fool me like 40 times, then I'm probably an intersectional feminist on Twitter. But moving on, okay. Oh, she's also doing a Woody Allen project, which I just love. I just like that she's, I mean, that's like really highbrow. I mean, despite a lot of his bad cultural baggage, he is still considered a great artist in the white world. So I find that interesting that she's able to do things like that. Whereas I think straight out of the Mickey Mouse zone, she would not have been able to do that. So I appreciate her hustle. Something else somebody asked me about, and I thought this was interesting. The day that I recorded and released the first episode of the podcast, someone pointed out, they said, hey, you debuted the same day as the March for Science. Who was that deliberate? And actually, it wasn't, but I'm kind of glad it happened because it was something that went to my point. It's just a happy coincidence that helped make my point. And I think the March for Science, I don't know much about it, but I think it's something that's very associated with liberals. And one of the points I made in the last podcast was this whole fetishization of rationality and science. It's not just something that white racists or white apologists from the great white men's school of analyzing history and culture indulge in, but a lot of liberals and progressives also fetishize this dedication to science and how it's something that they value their identity on. So I kind of like that march happened the same day and kind of led credence to the idea this is a bipartisan thing. This is just something that a lot of white people have, this valorization of science. I also think, I'm not sure if I brought this up last time, but I think that also leads to a lot of why Neil deGrasse Tyson, why a lot of liberals like him, because he fills both realms. Just the same way the white people who win the awards are the white people who can channel a black voice, but with what's perceived as a white dedication to craft and technical expertise. People like Neil deGrasse Tyson are kind of a flip side of that because he's a black scientist. And what he's doing is, because he's a science guy, but also because he's black and seen as having, whether it's really there or not, but the perception is there anyway, because people just kind of see what they want to see. The perception is that he has a certain type of black swag that he's bringing to the science. You know, same thing with Obama. Like, a lot of people see Obama and they just project on him a lot of extra black swag that's not even really there. Well, you kind of see it when people talk about Michelle Obama. People put up a tweet about Michelle Obama and say something like, yeah, Michelle Obama was serving looks. She was, you know, she was saying, hey, girl, blah, 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 blah. I've seen white liberals do this. Michelle Obama doesn't even talk that way. So, yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson, it's a lot of the same stuff I was talking about first episode. He is a human bridge to that black authenticity, that black swag, and that white stereotype of rationality and science. And I think a lot of his appeal comes from that, and he's tapped into that, whether deliberately or not. In some sense, it's always deliberate, even if it's not always conscious. There's a difference between conscious and deliberate. I mean, he might not be consciously saying to himself, I'm going to cash in on this. But I always believe black people on some level, we always realize what white people are getting out of being associated with us. And we tend to play up to it, even if it's on an unconscious level. Next question I was asked was, writers who shaped your worldview. I mean, I have a ton. So I figured rather than just go on this podcast about it, even though it wouldn't be a bad thing because it would eat up most of the hour, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'll put the details and links in the show notes, but just try to read the list through really fast. And it's not even an exhaustive list. I just think it's a good start. Neely Fuller Jr. Neely, spelled N as in Nancy, E-E-L-Y, Fuller Jr. All of his books and videos, to me, he's the best expert on racism living. I think he's probably, and when I say expert on racism, I'm not talking about like the Tim Wise type where it's just about, hey, white people, check your privilege, and then you pat yourself on the back. I mean, he just really brutally dissects the honesty of being white and black in the world, and especially in America, and a lot of the pathologies there. He has two books, but he has a shit ton of videos on YouTube. If you just Google Neely Fuller Jr., you can basically listen for hours. He's over 80 years old, and he's still sharp as a whip, and his mind is sick. Tariq Nasheed, Iceberg Slim, anything they've written. There's also an Iceberg Slim documentary that I think is really good. I think the rapper Ice-T produced or directed it. It's a really good one. I like most of all The Naked Soul of Iceberg Slim, but I also like Pimp and Trick Baby because they have like little isolated insights that are pretty good. There's a book called Black Players. Black Players was a book in the 70s by a husband and wife anthropologist team, and they decided to do their, I don't know if it's a thesis or a dissertation, I never know exactly what it is, but they decided to do their project, their anthropology final project, whatever it is, that last project you have to do. They decided to do it in the hood of Oakland, like in the Bay Area. They decided to study the world of black pimps as a, like as if they were a tribe, instead of going to study like a foreign tribe or something. They wanted to immerse themselves in this nation within a nation because that's what they felt black America was treated as, and they wanted to study a specific subculture. So they just immersed themselves into this pimp and player, and by extension also because the Bay Area had a lot of radicalism at the time. You know, Bay Area is what gave birth to the Panthers. Side by side, there was also a lot of radicalism going on. So the female ended up, I believe, if I remember correctly, stripping in a black strip club. And the guy just hung out with the pimps all day. And they just wrote about it. In some levels, the concept's kind of horrifying, but the product is so good. I mean, it's really good because it's very, very brutal. It's kind of honest in a way that I think wouldn't be allowed today. It's a pretty good book. They're called the Milners, M-I-L-N-E-R-S. I think the first names are Richard and Christina. It was out of print for like a long time. I had to spend about $100 to get this book. And then like a year later, it went back into print. So you can get it now for under $20. And the funny thing is, I don't even regret it. This, at $100, it was a steal. That's how good the insights in the book were. Also, the Hidden Colors documentaries. That's also by Tariq Nasheed. Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joy DeGruy. It's a book, but it's also a lecture. You can go on YouTube and Google Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joy DeGruy. And it's basically about the psychology of white and black people and how it all traces back to slavery, but just in a more refined form today. The lecture is about 2 hours, and it pretty much encapsulates everything in the book, even though I'd still recommend the book because the book fleshes things out better. But again, that's Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joy DeGruy. I'll try to put the link in the show notes as well to the video, not just the book. Any book on middle class and upper class blacks, which I think is, America's really bad at analyzing class versus race. I think if anything, America has very, very, very poor class vocabulary, as opposed to Europe, which has a great, great, great class vocabulary, which is why they have better class analysis, but tend to be lagging behind us when it comes to building a vocabulary on race. So in general, in America, we don't have a good class vocabulary. We don't even have a lot of good books on white class issues. So when it comes to black class issues, it's even worse. Books on middle class and upper class blacks. There's Black Bourgeoisie by E. Franklin Frazier. I think it's great. There's Rage of a Privileged Class by Ellis Coase. That's spelled C-O-S-E. And it's all about why are middle class blacks still angry? Post affirmative action, post this, post that, post civil rights, we shall overcome all that stuff. Why are black middle class people still angry? The Black Anglo-Saxons by Nathan Hare. Another really good book. That book nails a lot of stuff, and it's really easy to read. You can read that book in maybe an afternoon. It's very easy breezy read, but heavy on the knowledge. And Our Kind of People by Lawrence Otis Graham. That's all about the history of the black upper crust going back to slave times. And what's interesting is stuff a lot of black people themselves don't really know, because most black people get their black history from white people. So if white people don't tell them, they won't know. I'm talking about if a black person just gets it casually, like through school and through the media. I'm talking about someone who doesn't actively look for it. Then most of the time, you're basically just going to know whatever black history that the average white person knows. That's why if you ask most black people, you know, name some civil rights figures, name some deep cut black thinkers and theorists, most of the time, they don't come up with the same examples that a white person comes up with. They're going to say Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, you know, same thing. So by that token, a lot of the black upper crust and black high society, a lot of black people don't know this history because white people don't know it. So this book is very good because it's by somebody who comes from that world. The prose isn't the best prose in the world. It's not exactly a riveting read. It's pretty boring, to be honest, the way it's written. But the information is fascinating. It's just written in a very dry way. But the author, again, is Lawrence Otis Graham. The book is called Our Kind of People, and he just traces it all back to slavery and discusses all the secret societies and upper crust blacks, people who've been generations, who've been the Ivy League for generations, the Boule, the Jack and Jill social clubs, and a bunch of other things. It's good stuff. And he breaks it down by region in America. A wealth of information. It's pretty good. I mean, you know, I've had one other criticism besides how dry the tone is because he's unapologetically part of the class. It's kind of written in a very overly sympathetic tone in my book. He kind of buys into a lot of the hype that he's describing, and it shows through. Psychopathic Racial Personality by Bobby E. Wright. That's a book where a black radical writes and describes how racially white people are very much like psychopaths in their dealings with black people. And he makes the connection between clinical narcissism and psychopathy and the history of how white people collectively have treated black people collectively, and how black people collectively in the whole racial relationship of America basically behave as a codependent in an abusive relationship, whereas white people have a lot of the clinical traits collectively when dealing with black people as a psychopath or a narcissist. And also, that's one of my personal theories in general, that white racism is a form of collective narcissism, which is why most of my views on race are formed by just being generally obsessed with narcissism and sociopathy in general. That's where a lot of my insights come from. It's not from reading race, but from reading psychology and then collectively analyzing race through that lens. So, which kind of leads to the next type of books that I want to talk about, is just any books on narcissism or sociopathy. So, books by Heinz Kohut, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Kohut, or Otto Kernberg, Kernberg. Those are two classic experts on narcissism. Their books are very good. Shame, The Underside of Narcissism by Andrew Morrison. Any books and videos by Sam Vaknin. Vaknin spelled V-A-K-N-I-N. If you Google Sam Vaknin or look up on YouTube, he has a million videos and articles on narcissism, and I think he's pretty good. He claims to be a clinical narcissist himself and to be writing about it from the inside. Yeah, it's possible. Also, because I think narcissism is a form of addiction, whereas instead of being addicted to, say, drugs or alcohol, you're addicted to two things. You're addicted to small ego boost, or another way to put it is narcissistic supply. And you're also addicted to putting other people down. Those are the two addictions involved in narcissism. You're addicted to narcissistic supply, and you're also addicted to shitting on other people. So I like to read addiction books too, to understand racism. There's a couple of books on that. The Hidden Dimension, Psychodynamics and Compulsive Drug Use by Leon Wurmser. Wurmser spelled W-U-R-M-S-E-R. And another book called Willpower's Not Enough by Arnold Washington and Donna Boundy. Again, the title is Willpower's Not Enough. And they're both about the psychodynamics of addiction. And like I said, narcissism is an addiction. It's a compulsive search for narcissistic supply and putting down of other people. And racism is white collective narcissism. So it all kind of ties in. And I think it's a good habit to kind of think of how everything interrelates anyway. Like how you can read one thing and use that to understand something that doesn't seem related on the surface. I think in general, it's always a good intellectual practice to develop. It's a way to leverage your reading. What else is something that formed my worldview? Okay, it's a book called American Directory of Certified Uncle Toms. I think it's written by committee. I don't think there's an author, but you can find it if you look for it. American Directory of Certified Uncle Toms. Understanding culture, media, propaganda, I think is very good too. So I read a lot of books on that. If you're feeling ambitious, I always recommend Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan. Then, what I think is a very good book, Daniel Borstein, B-O-O-R-S-T-I-N. Daniel Borstein's The Image, and the book Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. The two of them go really well together. If anything, I would recommend reading them at the same time or consecutively. It's hard to go into what they are without taking up all the rest of the podcast, but The Image, I think, is really good for politics too, because it's all about how we kind of make fake events to write about. It's called pseudo events. And Amusing Ourselves to Death is about how we, in the post-TV world, we can't digest anything, entertain anything, read anything, unless we find a way to make it entertaining. That TV and media and movies, to a lesser degree, have made us this way, that we can't even process, discuss, talk at all unless there's an enjoyment factor first. And you kind of see that in a lot of how people talk about culture now, both in the left and right. They want to relate everything to House of Cards or make analogs saying, you know, is this person Voldemort or is he Harry Potter, or look at these Democrats who are just like the West Wing, and these people, which House of Cards character is this person in the Senate? And, you know, things like that. It breaks that down pretty well. This is something that's very good, but is really impenetrable to read. It's challenging. Simulacra and Simulation by Baudrillard. And just anything discussing the concept of hyperreality. It's a book called Nation of Rebels by the authors Heath and Potter. I think it was originally called Rebel Cell. And it just talks about how people corporatize and market this type of fake authenticity and this fake rebelliousness, and how corporations just kind of package and sell back to people this fake prefab version of being authentic or rebellious. It goes back from whether it's the days of the Beats to the hippies to the hipsters to whatever. It just kind of talks about all that. On Bullshit by Harry Frankfurt. By the way, these aren't in order of importance. On Bullshit by Harry Frankfurt. You can read this in maybe an hour or two. It's that short. It's really an essay. It's not even a book. It was an essay that was so good they made it into a book. But it'll really teach you how to kind of see through shitty arguments. But the most important contribution in it is the difference between lies and bullshit, which seems like just kind of a pedantic thing to concern yourself about, but it's really, really, really important to the degree that it's going to change a lot of how you see through shitty arguments. And I owe a lot to it regarding how I think. Anything by the psychiatrist Alfred Adler or by Karen Horney, it's an unfortunate name, but I think that's how it's pronounced. It's spelled Horney, Horney, but I believe it's pronounced Horney. Alfred Adler or Karen Horney. Just anything that they've ever written. I'm not even going to limit it to just specific books. Just those two. They're kind of saying a lot of the same things in different ways, but it's just an incredible framework for understanding people. It's very, very good psychology. And it's not very jargon-filled and clinical as Sigmund Freud is, even though they're kind of contemporaries and I believe studied under him. It's very, very accessible to lay people. Tally's Corner, A Study of Negro Street Corner Men by Elliot Liebow. That's spelled Liebow. He's a white sociologist who lived in the hood I believe it was in the 50s or 60s, and just studied dudes who hang out in the corner. And I always believe to understand anything, you need an inside view and an outside view, because both of them have their strengths and weaknesses. That's why some purists only want to hear these things discussed by, you know, black people who lived the experience as their life experience. Like, the idea of authenticity. But I always think there's something to be gleaned from getting both. So that's why I kind of like things like Black Players and Tally's Corner, that have a white person who's not from that world being immersed in it. I never think you should only study that. I think you should always get the authentic black view. And if you had to choose between the two, to go with the latter. But I do believe these type of books have value as well. The best book on class I think I've read, especially about class in America, is simply called Class, and it's by Paul Fussell. It's a very important read. I think everyone should definitely read that one if you have questions about class. It's one of those books where when you read it, everything looks different, and it has a kind of analysis you can just apply to everything. Like, you'll just sit in your house and look at knickknacks around your house and realize the class messages imbued, like, both in that symbol, and you'll also analyze yourself as far as, what am I trying to communicate by owning this, by displaying it? It's one of those things that not only makes you kind of look at the world around you differently, but also look at yourself. Any book that has to do with transactional analysis, it's a type of psychology. psychology that's all about the scripts people live, like what kind of personal scripts you're living by, and the psychological and payoffs and rewards behind a lot of behavior that seems self-defeating on the surface. And this is something that Alfred Adler talks about too, who I mentioned earlier. Every single thing you do, even if it looks self-defeating, it has what Alfred Adler calls a private logic. Like, for example, you might be afraid of being on a grand stage, doing something with a lot of people looking at you and having expectations, and then failing in front of a lot of people. So you might end up doing a lot of self-defeating and self-sabotaging behavior on a lower level so that you never reach that higher level and have to risk a bigger failure with more people watching you. So on the surface, all your self-sabotaging is illogical, objectively speaking, by the bigger standards of society and humanity. But on a private level, according to your private logic, it perfectly makes sense. And transactional analysis drills down into that concept about how a lot of the scripts that people live, a lot of the things that people do that seem self-defeating or backwards, all of it has a private payoff. All of it usually has a private logic that it's fitting. And once you understand that, you understand a lot of the backwards things that people do. So books like Games People Play by Eric Byrne, I'm Okay, You're Okay by Thomas Harris, Born to Win by, I believe her name is Muriel James. And I think there's also a book that's actually called Scripts People Live. I forget the author of that. I want to say Claude Steiner, but I'm not 100% sure. If I'm wrong, please don't get on me about it. If you Google Scripts People Live, you'll see who wrote it. Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. That's a really heavy book. It's depressing, but it's really good. But it's a very existential book. A Reader's Manifesto by B.R. Myers. That's just a book that's very good as far as seeing through pretentiousness in your criticism and building a critical eye that kind of sees through consensus, especially consensus among elites, to kind of see what's really good and what's not. Because I believe there's a certain amount of groupthink or hive mind among progressive or elite or yuppie type people where they think their taste is bulletproof and it's very easy to buy into that. And how a lot of things that seem highbrow are actually of poorer quality than things that are generally considered lowbrow, but people who like highbrow stuff aren't very good at seeing through their own type of groupthink and biases. So what I like about A Reader's Manifesto is it's based on an essay that first appeared in, I think it was the New Yorker, it might have been New York Magazine. I should have done better research, but whatever. And it goes on, it takes a bunch of critical darlings and just skewers them. And it brings up a bunch of middlebrow and lowbrow genre fiction and other things that he thinks actually make for better writing. And it was very controversial when it came out, especially because it appeared in the exact type of highbrow magazine that it was speaking out against. And it ended up becoming a book. What else? There's a book called The East, the West, and Sex by Richard Bernstein. And it's one of those books where I think it's a very valuable book to read. It's a very good book to read, but it's also full of a lot of bullshit and bad biases. Like, it's a book about the West, how the West views the East, but especially sexually. And a lot of it is just about slumming, which is a big theme of what happened in last episode, about how white people in Europe, in the West, have a certain type of behavior and repression and rules of decorum and civility that they follow at home amongst themselves with their own, but how many of them were attracted to the colonial places, to India, Africa, Egypt, China, all these places, to indulge the dark side, to do the most sexually adventurous, lascivious, perverted behavior, but how it was also a type of projection. Like, they would project a lot of these repressed, especially Victorian and bourgeoisie desires and dark urges and not really be able to own them, but then write all this literature and create this fertile imagination where foreign people had all these things. Then they would travel abroad and then indulge in all these things away from their wives, their children, their home society. You know, it's one of the reasons why that book, what's it called? The one Apocalypse Now is based on. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on it. The one where the phrase going native comes from. Joseph Conrad, what is this? Heart of Darkness, that's what it is. A lot of what Heart of Darkness is about and why Heart of Darkness so resonates with a lot of white people, especially of that era, the idea that all these urges are in other people and you go search out those other people to be able to live them out. But you also kind of blame the other people. You put it in them, then you say, oh, they brought this out of me. They made me this way. Being around them, which, you know, to tie it back to what I said earlier, you look at Miley Cyrus. She's kind of going through something like that. You know, she's like, she not only got the advantages of the slumming, but now she kind of gets to blame hip-hop for it and say, oh my God, it's so bad. They kind of made me do it. Because there's a certain amount of blaming in what she did in her interviews that went along with the distancing. There's a certain amount of scapegoating. And that, to go back to Neely Fuller, one of Neely Fuller's core premises is that a lot of dynamics stay the same. They just get refined and honed. So that Heart of Darkness dynamic still shows in what Miley Cyrus said last week. Is just a way more subtle, refined, civilized version of it. Yeah, I didn't even plan that. That tied together pretty well. What else? Oh, yeah. So back to this book about Richard Bernstein, The East, the West, and Sex. The author is very much an apologist for that impulse. So he kind of documents it, but he kind of acts as an apologist throughout and lets a lot of white people in the West off the hook as far as this, but it's still valuable because even through his apologism, he illustrates what I'm talking about. It's a book I really recommend for as far as the history of slumming and a history of the mindset that goes behind it, but it's also recommended because the author himself is fascinating to observe on a meta level as you're reading the book. Anything by Eckhart Tolle, you know, A New Earth, Power of Now, it's incredibly sincere stuff, but it's very good. I and Thou by Martin Buber. I don't know if he's a rabbi or a Jewish mystic. I'm not exactly sure, but he's a Jewish guy with a religious slant, and I'm not exactly sure if he's a rabbi or not, but it's spelled B-U-B-E-R, and it's called I and Thou. And it relates a lot to narcissism and objectifying people. Richard Rohr, that's spelled R-O-H-R. Anything he's written or any speech that he's given, he has a speech. You can find it on audible.com. It's called True Self and False Self. If you were to try one thing, I would say it's that. But a lot of that has to do with narcissism. Same with all of Eckhart Tolle's stuff. Did I miss anything? Yeah. Oh, Chinwezu. He's a Nigerian scholar and a very deep thinker. Spelled Chinweizu. And he has a book called The West and the Rest of Us. And it's a lot like how people have described Fanon to me, as far as this much, it's very much about the psychodynamics of colonization. And he's a very, very brutal guy. He's doesn't really mince words. It's very good. So yeah, The West and the Rest of Us by Chinwezu. And I think that pretty much covers everything. I would like to mention Frantz Fanon, but honestly, I've only read 40 pages of him. I've not really enough to feel comfortable acting like an expert on him, but it's what I'm currently reading right now, and it's incredible stuff. All right, so That was just one question, and it took 45 minutes, so how many more can I answer? Okay, someone asked this on Curious Cat. They said, T, I think racism equals tribalism made simple for Europeans and their worldview. Thoughts? I'm not 100% sure I even understand the question. I think I do, but I guess they're saying, is racism just a simplified form of tribalism? I think it's asking if racism is just tribalism, but with color. It reminds me of something I forgot to actually bring up in the first episode. Because the first episode, if you remember, the question that I was answering, that one was, why have white people never just eradicated black people once and for all? And I gave like this long answer on it that I stand by, but I did leave out one thing. At one point, I brought up how in Victorian England, the elite white people used the poor white Victorians for their projection in slumming, which is the role that non-white people came to play globally and in America especially. And that kind of leads to a part of the answer that I forgot to include the last episode, which is one of the reasons white people need to keep black people around, or just non-white people in general around, to project all the parts of themselves, good and bad, that they've grown uncomfortable with and want to cast off, is because without black people, they'll start doing more of this heinous shit to each other, which is what the state of the world was before there really was a concept of race and there was a lot of interaction with non-white people and especially black people. Like, this was the state of white existence before non-white people doing this shit to each other. And if we disappear, I think on some level they realize it's going to return to that, which in a way kind of keeps both rich and poor white people invested in racism. I think it's one of the reasons why it's not always easy to get poor whites to become class allies with poor blacks. If you and the rich guy are both shitting on the black guy, that's time that the rich guy is not spending kicking your ass. So when non-white people aren't around, other white people, usually poor, end up filling that scapegoat and abuse target void that gets left. So I don't think racism is really tribalism made simple for Europeans. I think Europeans were tribal way before races were even really a thing, conceptually speaking. I think racism is more a tribalism that just keeps white people from abusing each other as much as they used to. Somebody asked, you seem somewhat reluctant to accept any criticism of black men with regards to sexism toward black women. Do you not think it's possible to be both oppressed and oppressive simultaneously? And there were some more questions that, but they were just basically variations of that one. So, you know, it's not really worth repeating those questions, but I really hate that question. And I hate it because it's kind of dishonest. And what I mean by that is, like, there's a huge, it's a kind of like, Senator, when have you stopped beating your wife type of question? And actually, you know what? I will read the other question that relates to it. The other question was, do black feminists not have the right to critique black men? I'm confused by this. If there is a legitimate critique to be had, black women are the ones to make it. Now, both these questions, straight off the bat, are so straw man filled that you have to kind of unravel that before you even get to the rest of it. So let's see if we can do that. Okay. So what are the straw men that are being put here? I think there's a really good paper. It's by someone named Valeria Watkins, I believe. And she talks about This same straw man that I'm talking about. I'm going to put this paper into the show notes, but what she talks about is how there's this thing that intersectional feminists do, where they make black woman and intersectional feminist interchangeable terms, whereas there are plenty of intersectional feminists who are not at all black women, and there are plenty of black women who are not at all intersectional feminists, but by in the same paragraph or even sentence, K- casually using them interchangeably, they totally change the substance of what you just said. So, for example, they'll say something like that question that I just had, where she goes, do black feminists not have the right to critique black men? If there's a legitimate critique to be had, black women are the ones to make it. Not black feminists, black women. So it's a rhetorical sleight of hand. Within two sentences, she's gone from turning me into a critic of intersectional feminists to a critic of all black women, which is a very different thing. And it's very slick. It's very, you have to look for it because they do that a lot. And I'll even take it further. I don't even think intersectional feminists count as all black feminists. I think even just calling a certain school of intersectional feminists just black feminists, I think even that is too much. There are intersectional feminists, some of whom are black, some of whom aren't. There are black feminists who are a bigger umbrella, some of whom are intersectional, some of whom aren't. They subscribe to a different form of black feminism. Then there are just black women, some of whom don't subscribe to any form of feminism, at least not any form of academic feminism that you find in journals or anything like that. It doesn't mean that they're not progressive in their own way or fighting for equality. They just might not subscribe to any form of school of feminism. So the first thing I have to make clear is I do not in any way think that there's a problem with black women critiquing black men. That is the first part. There's a lot of valid criticisms to make of black men. The second part is, even if I do have problems with a lot of things that black feminists say, the specific thing I was talking about was something called, I like to call black men are trash feminists. Like, there's this feminism that it seems mainly focused on just trying to find things to blame black men for that they will put, that they will let white men off the hook for, or that black men aren't even guilty of, but white men are guilty of. And then for some reason, make black men the face of this thing that they're critiquing at any given moment. To give one example, for short, I call the black men are trash feminists BMATs, BMATs. One of the things the BMATs were recently critiquing and claiming is a bunch of them went on Twitter saying, ha ha ha, look at Serena. Serena Williams is marrying a white man and black men are mad about it. But they deserve it because they spent all this time bashing Serena Williams for being masculine and ugly, and it took a white man to appreciate her. And this is your just desserts for all the time you spent shaming Serena Williams as being dark, ugly, and unmasculine and gorilla-like, while white men were the ones appreciating her and showing her love, which forced her to go to a white man for love. And this is just an insane narrative. It's not even one that's even plausible because you can debunk it in 5 seconds. You just Google or do a Twitter search for the words Serena Williams masculine or Serena Williams hot or gorgeous, and you'll see it was mostly white men calling her a gorilla, calling her masculine, calling her ugly. A lot of them were trying to use Sharapova as a contrast, you know, to show what real femininity is like, and, you know, making implications that Serena looks like she's on steroids and is beast-like and whatever. And it's been black men who have made her a sex symbol for over a decade. It's not even something you really have to even search to debunk. And similarly, I mean, the only black guy I can even think of critiquing her anywhere near those types of critiques is Jason Whitlock. And anyone who knows anything about Jason Whitlock knows that he doesn't count because he's pretty much trying to woo the exact type of white guys who are racist. That's his lane. He's trying to appeal to a lot of like white conservatives and white racists. So he's pretty much the only example, and he doesn't even count as somebody you go to see what brothers in the street think. But that's a perfect example of like what I call the BMAT type of feminism, which I don't think counts as all black feminists, and I definitely don't think counts as all black women. I think the average black woman, if you ask her if black men had a tradition of hating Serena Williams and calling her masculine, and whether white men have been her champions in all the years she's been in the media, the average black woman's gonna be like, are you fucking retarded? Like, stupid? Like, what are you saying? You know, they're totally gonna see that it's not remotely based in reality, right? But the BMAT feminists exist in their own weird Twitter reality, where these things are only real on Twitter and Tumblr and have no bearing on the real world, and they just have an echo chamber that just helps keep all this stuff alive. So to go back to these questions, when you put it as in, hey, you know, you refuse to accept any criticism of black men with regard to sexism toward black women, I mean, come on. Of course, if it's not reality based, of course I'm going to not accept it. Like, accepting criticism of black men doesn't mean I have to accept anything they're accused of, even if it's blatantly untrue according to common sense. You know, it's ridiculous. And then also to try to pretend that a lot of these viewpoints are something that black women are making, that black women are interchangeable with black men, I mean, with black feminists, is also dishonest. I mean, most black women do not co-sign this, and you can even see it in the replies that those ridiculous rants got. In those rants, there were a ton of black women chiming in to say, this is the stupidest thing we ever heard, and a lot of you intersectional feminists have to shut up with this. So there's plenty of black women themselves who are saying, this is, you don't represent us. So that dishonesty, it's a rhetorical tool that they always, always fall back on. The whole, you're critiquing black women, or you have a problem with black women expressing their mind, which is not the same thing as being mad at or disagreeing with a very specific subgroup of a subgroup of black women. And to take it to something else too, right? She also says, when the question is also asked, do you not think it's possible to both be oppressed and oppressive simultaneously? That's a whole different issue. What I mean by that is, just because I don't think black men specifically have power to oppress black women as a group systemically, that they don't have the power to pass laws to give or deny black women jobs, to beat or abuse them without punishment and get off on it and avoid prosecution. Being that I don't believe black men specifically have that power to oppress, isn't the same as saying it's not possible in general to be both oppressed and oppressive simultaneously. I want you to catch the rhetorical trick there. What they're saying is, they're taking a general premise, which in some cases can be true and cannot be true, and pretending that if you don't agree with the very specific context in which they're claiming is true, then by default, you're saying it can never, ever, ever be true, which is another one of the rhetorical switcheroos, because, you know, that's ridiculous. Of course, people can be both oppressed and oppressive. For example, you can get a lot of white people who aren't elites, who don't have a ton of power. They're getting their ass kicked by elites, but they're still able to abuse and punish black people with impunity and get off on it in the law. You look at all those poor white people who would lynch blacks in Jim Crow, yeah, a lot of rich capitalists and rich people were shitting on them, but they were still able to abuse black people, lynch them, take pictures with their faces all shown. Those pictures became postcards, immortalized forever. And those people walked the streets to the day they died. Some of them are still alive, never prosecuted. Their faces are all on those pictures for people to see, sent around the country in postcards. So that they weren't even inside an envelope. These faces were just showing on the postcard. So for the whole journey this postcard took of the lynching, these white people's faces were shown and they got off scot-free. So the reason people do that, the reason that people will take your specific disagreement and try to restate it as if you're disagreeing with a more general statement is because it makes your stance look more indefensible. You see what I mean? Like, if I say, hey, this specific instance of this specific theory of someone being both oppressed and oppressive just doesn't make sense and isn't true, that's something that's harder to shout down. But if you can rephrase it as somebody making the broader, harder to defend point that this can't happen in any context, that no one ever in any situation can be both oppressed and oppressive, now you look like more like a crackpot. So that's the reason why this person sneakily rephrased it that way and put that straw man in there. And this is the kind of thing you have to kind of be cognizant about and defuse before you even answer a question like that. Because it's kind of like a trap. It's a booby trap. It's a rhetorical booby trap in a seemingly innocent question. So to backtrack, the rhetorical booby traps in this question, these two questions, that all black feminists speak for all black women, that all intersectional Twitter feminists speak for all black women who consider themselves feminists, and three, if you disagree that black men have access to patriarchy and the ability to systemically oppress black women, then you are somehow saying that no one in any context or in any situation can be both oppressed and oppressive. So I think that was a good teaching moment about kind of intellectual dishonesty and how you have to ask questions about the question before you even think about answering it. All right, so the last thing I'm going to say about this, right? If you want an example of the ridiculousness that I'm talking about and how it's not even all black feminists, but just a very specific group of crackpots, I'm going to put into the notes two Twitter threads that you can go through that list all the crazy things that BMATs, the Black Men Are Trash Feminists, have tried to blame black men for. And you can also find it if you just Google the hashtag, search on Twitter the hashtag blame black men. But you know, here's a list, and it's not even exhaustive. Black men were blamed for black women being fat, dysfunction in Black China's relationship with Rob Kardashian, Trump winning the election. They were blamed for Daniel Holtzclaw, the Eurasian cop who was raping black women. They were blamed, and this is serious, for not being happier at Beyonce's pregnancy announcement. Not even for hating on it. They didn't even try to claim that black men were hating on it. They just weren't being effusively happy enough. So that caused a big thread of black men are trash. They were blamed for George Lopez calling a black woman a bitch. They were blamed for one of the most popular syndicated radio broadcasts. But they were blamed on one of the most popular syndicated radio broadcasts, The Breakfast Club, as being the second leading cause of death among black women. Not cancer, car accidents, old age, but black men. They sent this on a huge platform that black men are the second leading cause of death among black women. And then it turned out to not even be true. Some people pulled up the stats and it was totally fake. No retraction offered, nothing. They just, you know how hard it is to unring a bell. So, okay, so that happened. They were blamed, as I said, for Serena Williams marrying a white man. They were blamed for white police officers beating up the little girl in Texas at the pool party. They were blamed for a group of black girls beating up a black woman and her daughter. But somehow black men were blamed for that. A white Instagram model, Yes Jules, I don't really know much about her, but just her existing, they were blamed for that. French Montana, an Arab rapper, called a black girl nappy. They were blamed for that. They were blamed for Imus calling black women nappy-headed hoes. Oprah did a whole show on that. Lil' Kim getting plastic surgery and having self-esteem issues. Black men were blamed for that, even though I know a lot of black guys who had her poster on the wall when I was growing up, but okay. White feminists erasing black women's contributions. Black men were blamed for that. This was a really interesting one. Black men were blamed for black women calling black men carefree black boys, which I don't even get. That was a strange one. I think that was Feminista Jones that said that one. The black hair care company, Shea Moisture, put a white woman in the commercials. Somehow black men were blamed for that. So somehow me pointing out those are utterly ridiculous things somehow turns into me saying that black women don't have a right to critique black men. Apparently, the only way I can show that I support the right of black women to criticize black men is to sign off on all these ridiculous things. And I kind of don't blame them for saying it, because a lot of straight black men on Twitter, I'm not sure why, on Tumblr or even like in academia, they'll gladly co-sign all of this. So it's not the most outrageous thing to demand, since a lot of people will actually do it. But like I said, I'm going to put all these links in the show notes, so you will see. Yeah, last question. What difference, if any, is there in being quote-unquote woke and being for quote-unquote black empowerment? And I think it's a good question. I would say the intended audience is probably the biggest difference. If you're doing it to get white people to love you first and foremost and accept you and, you know, give you a job and a platform, then you're probably being quote-unquote woke. You know, if you target it toward the white gays, and by gays, I mean G-A-Z-E, not G-A-Y-S. Just want to make that clear. Woke used to be the same thing as black empowerment, but once white liberals and bougie black Blavity, BuzzFeed, Black Media Twitter, Blue Check Twitter got a hold of it, because they pretty much think like white liberals anyway. Once they got hold of it, it became something else. Like, they basically co-opted the term woke to where it's basically unusable now. In the old days, woke was something that people in the street or people in the conscious community used to use, that is now something that the type of black person that you see represented in the movie and series Dear White People now uses. Like, woke is radioactive. No one conscious can really use it anymore. It's become a joke. So woke in its current incarnation is about primarily focused on the white gays. It's the white liberals and bougie black media, Blue Check, Blavity, BuzzFeed, Twitter combined together to form what I call the white ally industrial complex, where all anti-racism is kind of curated for the white gaze, and its primary purpose is to appeal to white empathy and sympathy and kind of prove the emotional worth and validity and worthiness to be loved of black people. It's very forged around white people, please love us. That's what being woke is. A very self-policing, can kind of be kind of like a bullying community too, because if you are anti-racist in a way that doesn't center the white gaze, or it doesn't, you know, appeal to asking white people to give you a platform, then they'll kind of turn on you. It's a very narrow way to be anti-racist. Whereas black empowerment, I think, is more about being targeted toward the black gaze and black people improving themselves and being independent and not necessarily needing to always get a slot on a white platform or to get a seat at the white table, but what can we do to make our own table? That's basically what that means. And there was another question that said, you critique performative wokeness very well, but I've noticed that there's seldom really any critique of what real wokeness would look like. What, in your opinion, would differentiate real wokeness with performative wokeness? I'll say this. If you're doing anything anti-racist and it doesn't center around white people, for example, white privilege talk centers around white people, it makes anti-racism become about white people soul searching and going on a Joseph Campbell-esque hero's journey where they come out the other side better people and now renounce their own privilege. Like white privilege is really about their journey, not about improving black people's lives and fortunes and wallets and pocketbooks. When you talk about anti-racism and you stop centering white liberals and you get to a point where they actually start turning on you, that's usually the point where you're probably actually doing quote-unquote real wokeness or real black empowerment, I would say. That's a good rule of thumb. When you start alienating white allies with your anti-racism, you've probably deliberately or inadvertently stumbled on real wokeness or real black empowerment. So that's a good umbrella answer. Like, for example, if you change the focus from white privilege and change the words to white supremacy and white power and capital and redistributing capital, you'll see a lot of allies suddenly be like, whoa, 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 whoa. I just want to check my privilege and talk about how I can get a cab easier than you. I didn't want to actually break any bread. You know, at that point, you've probably gone out of performative wokeness because now a lot of the grant money, a lot of the freelance writing gigs from the white-owned black sites, so-called black sites, you know, that's gonna dry up. So that's it. This is T. The Twitter username is Ricky Rawls. That's RAWLS. One word, no underscore or anything. That's Ricky Rawls on Twitter. Feel free to add me on Twitter. If you have any questions, the link is in the Twitter profile for the Curious Cat account where you can ask questions. Also, this is going to be a twice a week podcast. The first episode is going to be free. Second episode is going to be called the Problematic Premium episode, which means that you'll have to subscribe to it on Patreon. That's going to all be set up. I'll hash out the details on that, but there will always be at least one free episode a week, so you'll have that. All right, so I hope you enjoyed this. Take it easy. Talk to you on the flip side.